Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You scared of things that go boom, boom, boom?
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
I am Eric 13. I'm here with Michael Kester.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe we're talking about films that only Americans think are horror movies.
Yeah, that's actually probably pretty accurate.
Only in America are we. Last time you said this was a Something Is Very Wrong double feature.
You forgot the dot, dot, dot.
Oh, right.
Something Is Very Wrong, dot, dot, dot.
That part's still in my stomach, I think. It's still rustling around somewhere inside me. It's Magic Magic.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, every time you type that in anywhere, they want you to watch Magic Mike, but
right.
You should watch Magic Magic instead, at least this week.
With Michael Cera, with Magic Michael Cera.
With Magic Mike, oh, I can't wait to talk about these. And A Field in England, which I think is actually where...
You still, if that fever from last week has persisted, I bet you had a rough time watching A Field in England.
Listen, we just have to get into this stuff. Do you have anything that you want to say specifically about that theme?
Honestly, just that there was a third option. It was a film called Toad Road. And I don't think we would have made it through the show had that one been chosen.
You don't think we would have made it to the top of the Holy Mountain?
I don't know. But that said, we'll probably get Toad Road on here. I just don't know when.
Oh, good.
It will be a long time from now.
All right, so the show is going to be way better if you've actually seen the movies. I don't even think it's possible. The show will have absolutely no value to you if you haven't seen the movies.
It will be so diluted because the films themselves are...
it's a prerequisite, man.
Prerequisite is, yeah.
We're answering a question you wouldn't have asked if you haven't seen the films. So we're going to do Magic Magic first and skip to 24 minutes in. Then we're going to cover A Field in England.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very separate matter before we do that, Amanda gave to our Kickstarter and she sent me this link for iempathize.org. It's the letter I, you know, like me,
mm-hmm.
iempathize.org. So I was on there reading some stuff about this and it's a program that tries to prevent child exploitation through creating empathy. Really, she didn't say anything to me about it. And I kind of went on there and clicked through it and not something you want to do while thinking about these movies, move to a completely separate place. So you're going to have to pick a choice right now. There's a third chapter. You're either going to have to, I empathize first and then take a little breather and then watch some movies, or you're going to need to remember to come back to this. But, it was a guy who was doing some work internationally and encountered these cases of child survivors of sexual exploitation and came back here and decided that it's a cause that needs backing behind it to get people motivated
mm-hmm.
to fucking care. It's one of those things we talk about every once in a while that it just like creates this inner anger in me, this Citizen Four type anger.
Yeah.
Where you say something like, you know, we should do something about our privacy. And everyone goes, yeah, yeah, that is a problem, isn't it? Anyways, I'm going to go back to what I was doing. I say to you right now, there's child exploitation in the world. And we both knew that before right now. This is not news mm-hmm. to anyone. And one of the specific missions of this organization is to fucking shake people and go, yeah, but that's terrible. Hold on. We're talking about child exploitation. Can we actually have a conversation about this and not just all shrug and go, yeah, but what can we even do about it? I think more places should create a mission, not out of spreading awareness, but out of simply getting people to fucking care about terrible things in the world that we've all become immune to and shrugged off because they're too terrible.
Yeah.
Problems we can't fix because they're so awful. We don't want to think about them. You know, like watching Magic Magic, for instance. If you like both Yule Log and Funny Games on Netflix, you'll get recommended.
Yeah.
Magic Magic. Actually, I don't think it's on Netflix.
It's not.
Triangle is. You could do that one.
Yeah.
But This is a movie fucking littered with peculiarities.
Yeah.
The first and most obvious is Michael Cera.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So
I don't know if that's the best way to start. No, but why not?
It is because so when this movie was coming out and it was doing the festival thing, the big chatter was Michael Cera.
Mm.
We just talked last week briefly about Scott Pilgrim. I would say that that is probably my favorite place for him to be.
Mm-hmm.
So having already done This Is the End, where he actually just continues playing this character, I think that the conversation is less about he's not making jokes. It's more that he has such a handle on how to deliver the jokes he's making so that they're not funny, because the character thinks he's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not the normal divorce from Will Ferrell that we constantly get, where people go, he's not even funny in that.
Yeah.
In this, he's still making the same Michael Cera-esque kind of jokes, except he's playing it a lot more simple and he's delivering it in a way that's grating and not amusing.
Also, part of that character thinking he's funny is a little bit different than the... He's more laughing at the audience than the audience is laughing at him.
Sure.
It's not that he says something with a nervous chuckle. It's that he thinks he's about to deliver this really funny joke and no one in the room is laughing because he's a creepy weirdo.
Right.
And the entire way he plays this character, from the weird accent that he has and the... I've seen his role described as the eccentric friend, the effeminate friend.
The virginal friend.
Yeah, there is so much about this that how vague it is, how not immediately available, or the fact you can't put a word to it immediately. You want to talk about virginal. That is a Michael Cera word. That is a thing you could go back to label a lot of his roles. And we've had a Michael Cera conversation several times before, so I'm less concerned with how this is different from his other roles and more just with the fact that somebody was able to create this role or this character.
Sure.
And how fucking weird and off-putting it is.
Right.
Not that the movie needed this to be weird and off-putting, because I'm pretty sure it was going there no matter what.
Right.
I guess it's a good place to start to talk about this constant anxiety of the film.
Well, I think that the two big things that you just hit on that are really good kind of things to nail on the wall for this conversation are going to be anxiety and unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like the source of the former is the latter. It's that Juno Temple's character gets to a completely foreign place with a group of people she's never met before, many of whom don't even speak a language she can understand, and there is no way for her to identify or connect. And so she's kind of free floating in this very strange place, but it's not just the fish out of water thing when a character goes to a foreign country and Lost in Translation happens. That's fish out of water. This is more that she's moved in with a different tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Time is ticking. For some reason, you don't know what's going on, but everybody else seems to have a very clear idea of this purpose, but there is no finish line.
Well, the other thing about fish out of water that's very common is you recognize one side of it.
Right.
If not both, but I think it's more common you recognize both than you recognize neither.
Right.
And most commonly is, all right, we follow Alice in Alice in Wonderland. Mm-hmm. Alice is our somewhat normal character, although I think the story's aged so much that people shouldn't really recognize Alice. But let's say, you know, she is,
sure,
she's the daydreamer, normal Earth.
In the Jamie Foxx modernization, right?
And so we discover the crazy world through the eyes of the normal person. They're our hero, our protagonist, our rock. Otherwise, we get the alien who comes to Earth. We recognize Earth. We recognize the people. They react to the alien. We see both of these. Actually, we've seen both of these recently and frequently. And this is a movie that does more good old Kafka stuff and does more you're in a place, there's a ticking time bomb. Why is everybody so weird and out to get me? And then there's also a point where I think you realize that Alicia is insane.
Yeah.
And you go, wait, I have nobody to, you're just spinning out of control.
There's a really interesting moment too in the arc of the movie where they leave the sick puppy on the road.
Uh-huh.
And in the moment that feels just kind of like a little twisting of the knife,
mm-hmm.
you know, it feels like, that scene, I don't know if you remember it, that little brief Coen-y thing in No Country for Old Men, where every time somebody walks by the dead dog, they go, oh man, they shot the dog every time.
No, I don't remember that.
And it feels like that, where they just go, yep, we're going to shoot the dog too. That's where you are.
Yeah.
But you realize after the fact, especially in the very last visual moments of the film, that that was the last hand of sanity that anybody ever really played.
Mm-hmm.
When they see two puppies and you go, we'll take both puppies. And they go, we can't take both puppies. Should we take the sick puppy or the healthy puppy? And then there's that argument where in that argument, you're sitting going, I don't know which one to take. The sick one could be really sick. What if I get sick?
Yeah.
But the sick one needs more help than the healthy one. So you take the sick puppy and you go, okay, I feel good about this. And then eventually you go, ah, fuck the puppy. And you drop the puppy off.
Sure. You think it's a metaphor for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is the moment where empathy from the audience becomes difficult.
I think it's a little more of a signpost, maybe.
I think that you're sitting there from that point on going...
It's a fork in the road and you end up going through the trees once you choose the left path anyways.
It's perfect, yeah. Because then when you go to the scene to kind of exactly point out the thing, there's a scene with the jumping off the rocks. You know, mm-hmm. It's a very climactic moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sitting there going, I don't know if she's being a pain in the ass or if they're being jerks.
Yeah.
I can't honestly tell you who is right or wrong. And then and it's funny because the cinematography is such that since the camera's often handheld, you find yourself going, I'm just going to stand here and see what happens. Cause I don't think I can quite weigh in on this.
Yeah.
And that feeling just snowballs as the movie goes on until you suddenly wind up in some ceremonial murder chamber and you're just sitting there, everybody's fucking crying and you go, okay, I'm just going to see how this plays out. I'm just going to see how this goes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that observer factor, God, there's just so much to unpack here. All right. Start at the cliffs, right? I think I begin that scene going, oh, this is the scene where she's a scaredy cat. And then I get there a lot quicker than I think other people do. But as soon as we start looking over the cliffs, I'm like, no, don't go down there. Right. Never, this is only a terrible thing is going to happen in this scene.
For me, it's funny because I've actually done this. This is like a part of my life now that I've lived in Texas.
I believe I remember this incident.
Yeah. So I was the first one to jump in. And then our friend Dave.
And then your ex-girlfriend Hannah, who died in this.
Right. So,
R.I.P. Hannah.
She was standing at the top, not wanting to jump. And everybody's kind of going, just jump. It's water. Just jump. And she jumped in wrong and severely hurt herself.
Yeah.
Really badly. And so for me, I'm sitting there going, don't make her jump in, man. I've seen what happened. I'm sitting there with the reality.
Let me tell you.
I'm sitting there going, you guys know how this can end, right?
I'm here today to tell you a cautionary tale.
And I'm still going, yeah, it's not as high as Hannah's jump. Just fucking jump in. You'll be fine.
Well, and the other part that I felt like, you know, we needed to talk about that before unpacking was that as you are this impartial observer, which I agree with, a lot of times you're looking in at a bunch of weirdos and you're going,
stop hypnotizing her.
Yeah. As the situations become more severe, I also think you have to take a step back further and further with your hands up going, yeah. I don't know until you're so many paces back that you realize you are once again in the bushes staring in at a murder scene.
Right.
Going, I really feel like I should do something.
Yeah.
But I'm 20 paces back here and also everyone is murdery.
Well, it's definitely to the point where you're right. It's you're constantly being pushed further and further out of the identity of the movie to the point where when you get there, even though they give you all the logical steps, I'm sitting there. I feel like I blink and I go, how the fuck? Where the hell? Yep. Seriously?
Yeah.
And you just start sitting there. You look at each step you've made backwards and you go, was that the step I should have?
Uh-huh.
Maybe I should have.
Where did I go wrong?
Maybe I should have woken her up right around the time Michael Cera said, dance like a whore. Is that, would that have been approximately the right time?
Is that an appropriate time to have this intervention? Yeah. You become a kind of willing participant to, you can see yourself in court suddenly.
Yeah.
With a bunch of people looking at you going, uh-huh. And you just let this happen. Right, it's right. The scene from that Hitchcock movie. I don't want to spoil.
Yeah.
That we've talked about at some point. And you're going, oh yeah, wow, I was kind of a fuck there, huh? I guess I really, you know, you realize you're on the other side of that story where the person on the stand is telling it and you're going, and you guys didn't realize that this was a terrible fucking idea.
Right.
And the person is just going, no, I mean, I how do we get there? I don't know. It just led to that. And I'm not sure exactly how the movie puts you in that position, other than, I mean, I guess the steps themselves have to be, you have to have a loose grip on what's happening and reality. And then there has to be a little bit of urgency there to go, I can't even wrap my mind around Dance Like a Whore because it's all happening so fast. And then before you know it, people are in the fire. And then the other thing is, the part of this movie that was most apparent to me, but maybe most difficult to talk about, is that the mechanics of the movie are to induce anxiety into the viewers so much that you do become, I mean, really, you kind of become Alicia.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you realize she's off.
Right.
So it's not to, because they don't want you to be able to identify with the crazy person either. So you have it the worst of anybody, even in the group here.
Yeah.
In that you can't do anything. You're walking through this. No one identifies with you. And also you are becoming a victim to the constant buzz of the film.
You start feeling exhausted.
Yeah, definitely.
Not even just psychologically exhausted. You just start feeling, I mean, I watch this movie and I go, man, I could go for a nap right now. Not even just like, because I think it's a vicarious thing. I think I see it happen and I think to myself, oh, maybe I could just nap for her.
I mean, I guess I would use emotionally exhausted, which is a term that I use more and more frequently on the show. But from the beginning of the movie, I already know that we're using, you know, there's that thing we talked about in Rosemary's Baby, that infamous obscure angles where the audience hurts their neck trying to lean around a door that it's not in 3D and they can't see through. This movie opens where you can't see anyone's fucking head. It clearly violates the sort of headline basic rule of, before you even get to your rule of thirds, you know, the rule where like put the fucking person in the frame of the movie.
Right.
And it's already driving me nuts going, why are we cutting off people's, can move the camera up? What's going on? And it frequently obscures the actors even after that, where you're trying to see through objects that you can't, you know, thin objects that you're bars or something, you know, something that if you were actually standing there, you could cock your head just half an inch left or right and it'd be fine again. It's like anytime someone is filmed through the back of a police car or a cage and you're going, did they line their eyes up between the links of the fence or how am I supposed to look at this?
Right.
And you just, it's always in the position where you feel like, can you get out of the way? I'm trying to pay attention to what's, this might be important. I'm trying to figure out what's going on here. That's just the first of a million things that the film is doing to make you, you know, even to say anxious is too simple a word.
Right.
It has a focus on these items, you know, kind of like where a movie lingers on something to tell you, hey, this is going to be important later. That seems like literally every piece of anything in the film. They're just adding to a list of stuff that is really never important, but it's just going, okay, well, there's this thing. Remember this thing. Remember this thing. Remember this thing. And you're going, I can't keep up with all these things that I'm supposed to remember that we're never going to fucking call back to anyways.
Right.
I don't know if this movie's dubbed or not, and that fucks with me, which might not, this might just be my own psychosis at this point, right? The movie might make you question things that aren't even supposed to be questioned, but you're going nuts as you're watching it. And the moments where the movie is trying to do it the hardest, I still feel like, I want to say the subtlety is most impressive, but then you get to that first Minnie the Moocher, 1930s carnival scene. And it's so deliberately, let's put on this creepy song from the 30s. And I don't know why it's stuck on the radio. Look, a sick puppy. And there's some more obscured angles. And you realize the movie is throwing it onto you.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it any less effective. Then everyone starts talking over each other. The music blares, the puppy's crying, and you start getting these shrill, it's such good use of animal sounds, these shrill, high-pitched the birds that are just going through the entire film. There's just a constant background noise that's terrible of these birds all the fucking time. I think it's trying to make people go insane.
Yeah, I definitely think it's playing on that. Well, and the thing too is that it constantly throws you ropes to sanity. I think back again to the second scene on the rocks when the sheep falls in the water. You know, that lovely little gem, that morsel of joy. And as that scene is unfolding,
can I tell you briefly, I had to go back and watch it because I couldn't believe that that was what happened. And then I go, why did you make me watch that twice? I was like, no, that was the wrong thing to do, is go back and watch it again.
Well, so what's funny about that is it happens and I'm sitting there going, well, that's an obvious metaphor movie. Way to hit me over the head with that metaphor and then ravenously try to pull myself using that metaphor back to reality. I'm like, I have a grasp on something. I understand this. And I'm pulling and pulling and pulling and the rope ends and I'm in a fucking murder shed.
I don't know. First of all, I don't know what the fuck is happening in this movie. And secondly, I don't know if that even matters. When we get to that point, and then I think the character dies because I think the movie has to do,
I would agree,
the worst things possible to you. So that's how I know what the outcome is.
Right.
I can only assume that at least the end objective of the film is this exercise in torment and audience paranoia. And that's all that I can grasp out of it. And I desperately want to go back to pull more out, but going back involves, it's getting out of the cave and the descent and going, you know, we could really figure out what was going on if we just sent a team back into that cave. And so you leave this mystery behind you. I really want to poke at this murder scene, but I fear that nothing will come of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have no more subtle way to ask you this than what your takeaway from this movie is. This is a movie created to put you in the headspace of, is torment the right word? Paranoia?
Yeah.
Anxiety?
Yeah.
If you're, and again, I don't know if this even matters, but if you are the person concocting this film, what is success for you? Is it standing at the back of the theater watching everyone twitch out of their seats and start having a seizure on the floor?
I think...
Oh no, that's the point of a field in England. Sorry.
I think that the point of success is when the credits start rolling, nobody stands up. The point is to rob the audience of something they didn't know they walked in with.
And somehow I feel like I'm just going to be saying that again for a film in England.
So we've already seen, this is funny because Ben Wheatley he's recently become a fair giant in the film industry. He's got
This was the one I've heard of.
What?
This was the one I've heard of the two films today.
Yeah. He's got a huge movie coming out this year. High Rise. And then he's also doing an HBO series. I mean, he's made, capital MADE. He started with Kill List, which is the most double feature of his films and also the only one we haven't covered. And then he did Sightseers and then A Field in England. And A Field in England, when I first saw it, I've seen it a few times now, but when I first saw it, one of the big things I took away from it was, man, they made that movie. They made a period piece for next to no money.
That was your, wow.
Initially.
Mine was, I didn't know Neil Marshall did a remake of Valhalla Rising.
I mean, it, not my only takeaway, but I mean, I remember seeing it going, huh, that's a really interesting, you know, just the manufacture of the film really stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because I had put up a mental block to ignore the goings on inside of it. And I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel like this was a cheaply made movie. I feel like some, and I don't know how this works, but I feel like the majority of the budget was put into some sort of Lawrence Woolsey style. Everybody who watches the movie gets mushrooms.
Yeah.
And
yeah, right.
Then you see the film.
Yeah, it was spent on hallucinogens. That's where the budget went. It has a look to it that is very plain and at the same time seems...
minimalist, yeah.
Yeah, because it's in black and white, you immediately go, all right, so they paid a lot of attention to, you know, it almost pretentiously so. Anytime you see a movie that where it doesn't have to be in black and white because of the technology, but it still is, you go, okay, artsy movie, what are you doing here?
Okay, Francis Ha.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then really once you spend a minute considering the movie, I hope it's not a discredit to it to say that it doesn't look like it concerns itself too much with the aesthetic of the film.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's not that.
Well, I mean, I think that aesthetic is probably too broad of a term.
Hmm.
Maybe the production design, because
yeah, right.
When you say it doesn't concern itself with the aesthetic of the film, the first thing I think of is the still life tableaus.
Which
I think hammer in an aesthetic that I've never seen in a movie.
Yeah. Well, actually, to reference Valhalla Rising, I think Only God Forgives.
Mm.
We talked about something kind of similar where you could have done the whole movie just using still photos,
yeah,
instead of things moving, because they do. You're watching one of those art exhibits that have real people standing in the place of statues.
Right.
Yeah. It does pay a lot of attention to what the viewer is seeing. I mean, it does seem stupid of me to say there isn't a deliberate attention given to aesthetics in a movie that has a warning before it that they're going to do a
strobing
insanely
effects.
Edited.
Yeah.
Man, let's talk about double features for a second.
Uh-huh.
After watching Magic, if you immediately want to put your audience on edge, just place a fucking inner title at the beginning of the film saying, warning, there's going to be some flashing images. I literally go, oh, come on. I went, okay, so you're not going to just spoon me for the next 2 hours, because that's what I was hoping for.
Right.
And instead, it's like, just so you know, this next movie is going to be a little rough. Damn it, double feature. And what we get is something that I think should be at the bottom of the film obscurity chart, and the fact that it's High Rise Guy making the movie.
Yeah.
Fuck all the film obscurity chart stuff. We have a 2013 film that may be weirder than half of those movies by a director who it shouldn't be. It's that funny guy from Sightseers.
Yeah.
And the other thing that bothers me so much about that is that I feel like my job to talk about Ben Wheatley, I mean, it's not that I don't recognize him in this. I totally recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
This film has a very much their sense of humor.
Right.
At the same time that I'm stumbling through this backwards existential period drama comedy thing, trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. I'm also going, yeah, there's some Ben Wheatley jokes here.
Well, I think
like a lazy Netflix Saturday afternoon.
Right.
You know,
I think that the comedy, and it's weird because it's more of a poignant type comedy and less of a ride along to type comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where, you sit there and the dialogue is so well orchestrated for period work.
Mm.
You just sit there and go, huh, how good. How lovely. I love this. Enjoying this. Huh. Mm. They talked so differently.
Well, yeah, it's a simpleton. You know what it is? It's like a Carl Pilkington type of existentialism.
Right. Yeah.
Where the movie's just, some parts of it are so plain where, if people don't know Carl Pilkington, this is hard for me to relate to, but if you do know Carl Pilkington, you already know the scene with the ant. There's a macro shot of an ant.
Yeah.
It's trying to climb up out of the pile of dirt, isn't it? Can't get out of there because the dirt's slippery. Falls down.
Right.
I mean, that's the whole,
yep,
the whole philosophy. And it's just, I imagine Ricky turning to Carl and going, you know, is this God punishing us? And Carl's like, well, you know, it should be because he's got to punish us for everything, doesn't he? It gives it to you so plainly,
mm-hmm,
that it seems to, the thing about the Carl Pilkington existentialism, if I can try and hold on to that, the thing that makes that work, you are getting something that seems to be fascinating and enlightening,
mm-hmm,
but from a person who can't possibly realize what they're saying is enlightening.
Right.
It's enlightening for how distilled and simple it is.
Right.
If it were a quote from Benjamin Franklin,
yep,
if it were a quote from Charles Dickinson,
mm-hmm,
then you would go, ah, he really spent time. This is Picasso's bull. He spent time going, how do I use four words to say something so plain that everyone will read it and go, wow, that really is how the world works, isn't it?
It is what it is. Oh, that's five.
No, it's not that phrase.
I guess it's four words. I just repeated one.
It's almost, and so it goes.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Totally.
I mean, that's even a little too complicated. But then Carl Pilkington creates these phrases because he only knows four words and then puts a period at the end of them.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, you really don't know how accidentally profound that was. And so when you look at the ant and you go, he's trying to climb out of that hole, but he just can't get out of there because he just can't get a footing. And that's it. And that's all there is to it.
Right.
But it's still somehow so
right,
metaphorical and deep and profound about it that you kind of feel like you're on the stupid end of that.
Yeah.
You're going, I mean, I'm feeling like there's so much to grasp and I'm not soaking in all the movie is trying to give me.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the movie's going, what are you talking about? It's simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. Why are you?
Well, that's the thing. That's the ultimate betrayal that's going on in this movie is that the simplistic look, the lack of color, the lack of cast, the lack of set pieces, you sit there going, this can't be hard. This can't be hard. And I'm lost.
Right.
There's nothing fucking here. The set is a tent and a fucking hole.
Yeah.
And a field in England.
Yeah. What do you mean?
They're telling me where I am. I don't even need to surmise.
Yeah.
The first thing is somebody walks on the screen and basically goes, sure is a English Revolution, isn't it? You go, okay, so I'm in a field in England during the English Revolution. There are four guys. What the fuck is happening?
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's go back to minimalistic, which originally I almost disagreed with because in my head it's so complicated.
Yeah.
And it's not that I think we're overcomplicating it either. I really think it's that complicated.
Yeah.
But when you stare at it and you stare at it so hard and you know there's only four elements and they it's some kind of riddle, you know, there's I can't even think of one simple enough.
Yeah.
To satisfy, you know,
well,
there's a chair and a light bulb in the room and the light bulb won't turn on. And how did the chair get there?
Yeah.
It's just it's some fucking riddle with two pieces in it. You're just going, wow, so there's a four walls or the chair.
Is there a door? Is there a door in the room?
Yeah, right. Like, can I ask a question, Moby? can perhaps you give me more information outside of, are they on an island floating in space? Are there only four people in the world? Was there really a war?
Is this a second English Revolution far in the future?
Yeah. And I don't know.
Well, I feel like around the time you go, I think I know what's going on. There's like a point where they go,
everybody does shrooms.
Well, that's the thing is you go, I think I know what's going on. And there's a point where somebody goes, yeah, we've been eating a lot of mushrooms. And you go, wait, when did you start eating the mushrooms?
Yeah.
Because I feel
a little bit more like you go up to them and go, guys, I get it. And they're like, good job, mate. Want to eat some mushrooms?
Yeah.
You go, well, God damn it.
I feel like, to put this in another way, I feel like the movie is two sentences. To kind of expand your Carl Pilkington idea.
Uh-huh.
I feel like the movie is two sentences. And the first sentence is the film independent of the psychedelia.
Mm-hmm.
And the second sentence is the film entirely of the, you know, the mushrooms. And I feel like there's an order in which those two sentences tell the story. I don't feel like they overlap. I feel like there's one and then the other.
This is where I have to start asking you riddle questions though. Can the second sentence go inside the first sentence?
Yeah, I think probably.
Can I use a semicolon?
Well, no.
Is it a conjunction?
No, I feel like the only punctuation is capitals and periods. I don't think there's even fucking commas. but anyway, because I think that there's a point in the movie where you're firmly in reality. And then a point in the movie where somebody may or may not come back from the dead, where you go, I think we're in a metaphorical place now.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe he just came back from the dead. It's possible at this point.
The giant blackness in the sky. Is it a black hole that's consuming the earth?
Right.
Is somebody just seeing it? Am I just seeing it?
I think that somewhere the center of those two sentences comes from using a big rope and a turnstile to pull somebody out of the ground.
Yeah, well, that's again, it's the fucking metaphor where we're all pulling on a rope and I'm not really sure what's on the other end of the rope, right, or why we're pulling it.
And then is what we get the devil is the follow-up question.
Yeah, perhaps we shouldn't have been pulling on a rope if we don't know what's on the other end.
Yeah. And the thing that's funny about that too is we get the introduction of that character, who I think they do definitely parallel a devil demon element, right? That's what's going on there. But what's funny about that, and what is so expertly fuck up worthy, is that they go, this guy might be the devil. And then one character goes, hey, I've been looking for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And you're like, wait, what do you mean you know this guy?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, he's some fucking guy. He took some shit from my boss.
Yeah. Right.
And then went and hid in the dirt.
It's a briefcase of dirty laundry, I think, is what he has. And so this is where I start to think maybe there's more that I can ask the film.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not as minimal as it pretends to be, that there is something that happened before this event that we do not have the whole story, but they seem to, because the other characters kind of go, oh, this guy, it seems to go, nope, you have all the information that you really need. He's just, there's no more backstory. He's a guy, he stole something. And then that's pretty much all of it. As if to say, well, we're going to give you another element, but we're not going to let you use the excuse that, oh, I don't understand because I just walked into this mess.
Right.
It's going, no. You still have all the available information.
Yeah.
The moment for me is not finding the devil. The moment for me is I'm going to get revenge high.
Yeah.
I'll show you. I'm going to lay down in the dirt and eat all the evil.
Well, that's funny too, because that, similar to Magic, there's a point in there where the film throws you a bone and you go, Eureka, wait, what? because there's a 2001 style drug trip montage with strobing.
Yeah.
Where you're, unlike 2001, I'm able to watch 2001 and go, this has no palpable rationale other than, whoa, this is crazy and something weird is happening.
Uh-huh.
In A Field in England, it feels like fucking 40 lashes because I am painstakingly scouring everything that's blinking, going, where's the answer? And what are the two things I'm seeing juxtaposed here? And what, how do they apply to each other? My eyes are fucking bleeding because I won't blink.
Yeah, right.
Because I'm going, so he keeps turning to the left, but also turning to the right. And that whole thing goes on. And I feel I could have compiled a notebook of information that I didn't understand.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the follow-up scene where the undead guy goes, they're over here, devil. And he turns just like he did in the just like he did in the Strobe montage.
Uh-huh.
And I go, oh, just like the, wait, everybody knows.
Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't help me at all.
I feel like I'm going to point at it and elbow the dude next to me. Be like, you remember that from the thing that literally happened moments ago?
Uh-huh.
That's applicable now.
Well,
at which point they'll go, yeah, everybody's seen the movie. We're all sitting here.
Well, it's a drug trip, isn't it?
Right.
We're all on hallucinogens. What makes that so painful for me is the excuse that I would normally have is to go, well, it's clearly an insane filmmaker on drugs. And that's the excuse I gave myself until the end of the movie when I noticed that there are two editors on the film,
mm-hmm.
which means at some point it's, and I know this doesn't have, it's not, you can't go into a box and make a movie and then just run out with it. People have to see it and you have to talk. I think you have to talk about it with people. I don't think you could just make it and then give it out. I think editing has to be a collaboration. But I know for certain there are two editors and they must have at least spoken about this scene.
Right.
If not, worked on it together. Like, here, you work on one frame and I'll work on the other and then we'll just mash them all together. Or at the very least, here, I made this psychotic drug scene. Amy, what do you think? I think it's brilliant. Put it in the film.
Yeah.
So two people agreed that this was a good idea and that it tells something and that it is central. It's not just the nightmarish vision of one man.
Right.
And the other thing is that the other goddamn editor is the writer of the film. So it's not even just like two people got high together and came up with this scene. It's that they really thought it was central.
Sure.
The writer went, this is exactly what we need. And the director said, that's exactly the way to portray it or whatever the fuck happened. And then they give it to you. And like you said, you compile a whole notebook out of it. And I'm still not really sure that any of those notes are, when we watch Bright Falls and there's that moment of it where they reveal the notepad
uh-huh.
and it's just like, got crazy demon stuff on it. That's sort of, I feel like we woke up from the blackout
yeah.
of coming through the seizure. This might be what people feel like on drugs though. They feel enlightened.
Maybe.
And I'm not sure they got anything out of that, but they really think they did.
Here's the thing is right around the time you start getting to the point where you can start rationalizing, maybe Tool is better if I take LSD. They blow someone's fucking leg off.
It's the greatest.
And there is,
until they blow a face off, by the way.
There is no, in my limited knowledge of recreational hallucinogenic drugs, none of those drugs are improved by watching somebody get their leg fucking blown off. That never, you never go, oh man, I would like to see that after I've consumed peyote. That would improve this scene.
Right.
Or I need to drop more acid and watch that guy's fucking leg blow into a million pieces. That would be way cooler.
Sure. You think
in my, and I'm limited. I don't know. This is a rubish, naive opinion, but from what I understand about recreational hallucinogenic drugs, that might fuck with you a little bit.
It might give you a heart attack.
And so I go back to going, that might be the stamp where he goes, you better not be taking drugs at this point. You know, it might be the moment where he goes, don't bail on me yet.
Right.
Spit those out.
Right. Right. You're going to need to use your active brain for this next part here, for this next exercise. I guess I would agree with you on that. I didn't think about how painful that might be I could see somebody turning and going, whoa, listen, I'm really high. I can't take stuff like that right now.
Right.
Don't.
Exactly.
Don't give me that. Although, you know, every time we do this on the show, we go, listen, I've never done drugs, but we get an email that looks like a page of demon notes that's completely incoherent. And people write to us and they think it makes sense. They're like, listen, I know you guys have never done peyote, so let me break it down for you. You see, there's a tree in the woods. And then like a deer comes charging in, but he's got these crazy horns on him. And then like my grandma's there, but she's not my grandma. And suddenly we're in a mall. No, that didn't help you at all. Thank you.
A mall in England.
Thank you, dear listener.
Good joke, dear listener. Nailed it. <It's>...
Right. I think that was a reference to it's a dream, and let me open my dream book and tell you what it means. I believe that was a reference to a series one or a year one rant on dreams, which means we have a website. We're no further enlightened than when we started, are we?
I think we're in companionship. We've developed a kinship of disenlightenment. That's what's happened.
You know, you're born, you run around confused, then you die, don't you? Huh? Website is doublefeatureshow.fm. Double feature show at don't send us email. I know you're already writing drug emails. Don't send them. Just don't. I don't want any email. The other thing that was on year one is me and you and everyone we know in Primer. I don't mean to keep doing these at the end. That was intentional once, and now I've just fucking up, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
Producers, I said last week, and
Jonathan Radke, Eric Tachek, Maxwell Harley, Mike Shaw, Dust, I don't know, Lexi Love.
All right, it's Jonathan Radke, Eric Tachek, Aaron Shore, Debbie Starin, and yes, Lexi Love. Those are the executive producers. Lexi's actually thinking about producing something else with me. I mean, nothing to announce or anything. Just reminded me. This was a perfectly weird show for two perfectly weird movies. I loved having that conversation. It's hard to get my bearings back. Hey, here's something I know we're supposed to do. We're supposed to talk about next time on this goddamn show. I really hope it's two movies that I'm going to have some sort of input on.
Yeah.
And not another great example of two movies that we know the least about.
So here's what I can tell you.
Please.
You'll have a lot to say, but you may need to wait one more week on I Empathize, or just maybe give yourself a 3-day buffer. I Empathize 3 days, and then watch Calvary and Philomena. Because,
oh yeah, those don't sound like titles.
If you think you knew how fucked up the Catholic Church was, wait until you watch a couple of elderly people fall prey to it.
Well, this sounds like another good time here on Double Feature.
So I guess they're also two Academy Award nominated movies.
Oh, good. So somebody else signed off on this.
Go fucking figure. Written on the sheet here, it says The Damages of Faith, which are, I believe, four words, very profound. I believe that was Ben Franklin. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.
I feel like the point is to rob the audience of something they didn't know they walked in with.
Oh, we're not going to get any better than that. Magic is fucking terrific. For as much as I just said it committed a crime against humanity, I think it's amazing, and I don't know where the fuck it came from, except, you know,
Chile.
Yeah, right. and see it, I guess, or don't do that. Just really thank you, film, and also fuck you, film.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.